my name is Robert Higgins, and this is episode 12 of Screenwriting from the Trenches, a podcast about the craft and expression of screenwriting in all its forms from the perspective of writers just like you. Kate is still in New York this week. So we have another guest host, the lovely Paige Feldman, author, writer, director, and most recently YouTuber. If you've seen her page, and I have, as she documents her journey to make her future feature film, Kaleidoscope. How are you, Paige?
I'm doing great, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing super, super awesome. Just trying to get through this thing where everybody's starting to wish mm-hmm. like Merry Christmas, and it's freaking me out because I'm like, it's too early for that, isn't it?
I mean, Hanukkah's over now. So for me, the holiday season's done. I just have to get through New Year's and then we're good. So y'all can say Merry Christmas as much as you want.
Fair enough.
I've finished my obligations.
Fair enough. But as a guest host, Paige is here to help us with today's topic/interview, how to decrease budget without decreasing story, part two, with our other guest, Josh Caldwell. Josh, thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Josh, I'm really glad to have you on the show because I've wanted to talk to you forever. I've been a huge fan of your journey as a filmmaker. We're going to get into that because I got some questions that I've wanted to ask you for a very long time. So first we're going to start with what we always start with on this show, which is what was screenwriting Twitter fighting / talking about this week? The first thing we're going to talk about is our sort of continuation from the last episode where people are starting to get like responses to their grievances about their notes from the Austin Film Festival. The tea was spilled heavily in these last 2 weeks about the Austin Film Festival, and the Austin Film Festival got back to people, and they seemed to have no sort of they weren't sort of admitting culpability, but they were saying, you know, we're looking to your concerns. But then there were some nasty stories that came out about like how they don't properly hire readers, and the readers that they do hire are not paid very well. The people that work for them are not paid very well. Paige, did you catch any of this?
I did. And I it wasn't from Austin, but I have been the victim of similar, you know, it was in my case, anti-Semitic, but there were so many comments that were either nonsensical or racist, misogynist, homophobic, etc.
Yeah.
And in my case, the screenwriting competition actually gave me a free entry for the following year for the same script to get different feedback. I mean, I don't know what that was about, but the everything coming out about Austin feels like it's just an open secret. I've heard that.
Yeah.
The readers are not paid in money. They're just paid in as many scripts as you can review. If you do X number, you'll get this free badge.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's not a great way to run a contest. It just seems like now that the quality of the notes has gone down, it's now becoming an issue, which...
Yeah, it feels like the screenwriter version of We'll Work for Food. So, like,
yes.
Yeah, like, sort of, here you go.
But can I say, is it that surprising? You know, I mean, I feel like if you're submitting your script to a contest to get feedback, you're submitting to the wrong place.
Thank you,
like
Josh.
Your script is either going to place or it's not. And if you're expecting valuable feedback from that experience, I think you should go somewhere else.
Well, that sort of leads
your entry fee and put it somewhere else, you know.
There
you go, because Paige famously got sort of a lot of notoriety from I think our sort of joint favorite podcast Script Notes because she put the money that she would have been putting into contest into a it was a podcast of her own. You did you got, was that the reason that you got invited on to Script Notes? Because then you were
So it's actually kind of bookended. So I decided to do, I have an audio rom-com series, the pilot's out. I'm actually wrapping episode 10 tomorrow, which is the end of season 1, which is crazy.
Right on.
But I was invited. I'm a Script Notes premium subscriber. I entered a lottery to be on, play a game on one of their live shows, live on YouTube during the pandemic. And I won and I got to play a game with Ryan Reynolds and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, which was super cool. But the cooler part of that, at least in my lore, my personal lore, is that John August said, hey, could you please record your audio on your microphone, an external mic that you have, and then send it to me because the audio quality is better if it's not coming directly from Zoom.
Right.
And so I did that and sent it to him and realized, wow, that cost me $0. And the audio sounded good because I listened to it later on the podcast just to see what it was like. And I thought, wow, that's a super cheap way that I could take this pilot that I love that I knew would be a great podcast audio drama and make it and actually make it. And that's when I figured I could budget X number of dollars for actors, X number of dollars for music, and everything else, the editing, all that I could do myself. And so I decided, and it was Austin who just gave me some, I just felt demoralized after not moving on and thought, well, screw this, because I know I'm good and these contests aren't seeing it. So I just started saving that money and $1,500 and 4 months later, I had a pilot.
Jesus.
And then I wrote into Script Notes about it and told them, and I have a thing posted on John August's blog about it, et cetera.
There you go. I mean, what was the last, like, I could have happened recently. What was the last script you've heard of that went into production because of a contest?
This is a great point. And I was,
I mean, and I guess if it got you an agent, sure. But where are those writers, you know?
Right. I like the, I was a development exec for a while and I would go and look through these contest lists and I would request some of the scripts, but no one was writing with the market in mind. And what we were looking for at the time at this company I was at, nothing fit the remit. So they were good scripts. They just weren't, anything for us. So
yeah.
Right. Well, you know, that, I don't know. I'm no lover of contests, but I have sort of a caveat in that if it hadn't been for at least the Script Pipeline contest, and I'm not endorsing them in any way, shape, or form, but if it had been for that, I would not have met my co-host, Kay Tuxford, you know, she of New York. But I think that's probably the only thing that I got out of a contest. Like, I just, you know, I sort of with everybody else where you have those terrible stories of, you know, you spend so much money and then sometimes you don't even get your feedback. Like sometimes you don't even get it, which is
right.
Really strange to me. Like this is a service that you paid for. And that's the thing that really sort of is at the bottom of this whole thing where people paid a lot of money for these, for the feedback. And then it was like, where did the money go? Because it clearly didn't go to the readers. So right. Where did the money go? And you know, as you know, Desi Arnaz would say, Lucy, you got some splaining to do. But anyway, let's move on to our sort of interview with Josh Caldwell, where I'm gonna ask you the question that I've always wanted to ask you, which is, why did you write a movie in French? Why? Like, where did that idea come from? Like, I have to know the genesis of this.
That's you want the story of the whole movie or just this, just the French aspect?
Just the French aspect, because right. If they want to know the story of the movie, they can find it on another podcast, including in our thing. But I want to know where that idea came from.
I mean, probably the spark of it was, I remember years prior, a movie had come out called Maria Full of Grace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was all in Spanish. And there was a lot, every story about it was how the director didn't speak Spanish and directed this movie in Spanish. And that just seemed to be like an aspect of the marketing that caught on to it. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. That's a story, like doing a movie in a language you don't speak, right? True to form, here we are, you know, seven, 8 years later and people are still asking about it. And it became French because I, you know, was a little bit of a nod to French New Wave, which was sort of the spirit of the, you know, the way we made the movie. And also because I just happened to know actors that spoke French. I think if actors spoke Spanish or spoke, you know, if I had those actors in mind, I would have changed it up and she would have been, you know, somebody coming from Spain, you know, and right. Instead of France. And so it was really like, not that much thought was put into it. It was sort of like, you know, but that whole movie was, but in a lot of ways, like that movie, it's because the movie was engineered, right? I hate using, you know, it takes the, people say it takes the art out of that to talk about
it,
but it was, I mean, you start from a place of saying, I have this much money. I want to write something that can utilize that money in the best way. And what do I have around me? And I just inherently felt like I had never seen a foreign film set in an American city before. You know, and so I just thought that was a really interesting way to do it. Like, and even though it's a city that a lot of us know, the very act of putting it through the eyes of somebody that, you know, as far as the audience knows, doesn't speak the language,
right,
just changes, it changes the perspective on the, on Los Angeles. And so, you know, I think that I thought that was a more interesting way to go than, you know, somebody that was from New York traveling through that city, or somebody that was just new English. I think that having studied abroad and having had that experience abroad, like there's a difference between somebody that speaks the language and doesn't speak the language and the way in which they're able to find their way, you know, through an adventure or through an experience. And so it created a lot of obstacles to have a character not speak English. Mm-hmm. And that necessitated them being from a different country and speaking a different language. And French just became the language of choice. And I got very fortunate that we had the actor that plays the motorcyclist in it was a really great guy. And beyond being an actor, was just, you know, had started getting into producing and directing stuff of his own. And he actually was the one that did all the translations and oh, wow. was there on set to really make sure that it was coming through correctly and it was being spoken to correctly. And of course, I think if you're a native French Parisian, you know, some of the dialogue is probably off, but, you know, who cares at the end of the day?
Well, that's sort of emblematic. I feel like a lot of your filmography is sort of emblematic of our topic, decreasing budget without decreasing story. The other thing that you did, which really blew my mind, was the way that you shot negative. Like where the studio, I gave you, I think it was 100K.
Yeah.
And like wanted you to do it, I think like that traditional like 12-day like kind of like or am I getting the days wrong, like it was like that
I basically said when I pitched it to him, I was like, you're just gonna give me the money and I'll go make it and I'll deliver it. And they said, all right.
That's amazing.
I mean, it was predicated on the fact that we had very little money, you know,
right.
I mean, it was, you know, not 100 grand seems like a lot, and it's also not a lot depending on what you're trying to do. But there's no, you know, I layover and negative and even our approaches with other movies that didn't get made was just this idea that often, you know, what you're doing is you're limiting sort of sets and you're limiting all that stuff. And but you're maintaining the same level of crew that you would on much higher budgeted movies. And
right.
So in that regard, in a lot of cases, unless you don't know how to do a lot of this stuff, you're spending a lot of money that's not on screen, and you're left with a movie that takes place in one location or has two people. And I personally find those movies not great. Like, I think that there's very few that really work, you know, and at some point you just feel the time, you know, as you start getting into a place. And not that you maybe don't in my movies, I'm not saying mine, just because they're in multiple locations, they're moving and they're quick, but I just think it's very challenging to pull off the one location sort of type of movie. And I think that it often, you feel the sort of conceit and you feel the contrivedness of it often because they're just having to stretch, you know, and that kind of thing. And that was challenging on layover too. I mean, you know, it's not like we had 50 locations and was an action movie. I mean, it opens with a 10-minute long conversation, one-sided conversation on a phone. But I just was like, maybe there's a different way to flip the script. Maybe there's a different way to make these movies where you reduce the crew and you can instead take all that money and you put it into the ability to give your movie scope and give your movie scale that you might not be able to achieve, you know, if you were having to pay a lot of people, you know, on set, because that comes with having to feed them, that comes with transportation, that comes with like all this stuff that, you know, really makes it challenging. So like when we did layover, there were 4 people on set, you know, and when we did negative, I'd say 80% of negative was shot with 4 people on set. You know, and there was the other 20% we scaled up for the shootouts, for anything stunt wise, anything bigger, right? Like where we like, okay, but we only needed to pay them people for 2 days as opposed to paying them for 30 days or 20 days or 10 days, whatever it is?
So this is, I love this question because it is talking about the state of the industry today, where most films are either like the tiny indie that could, that, and the tiny indie that could means $1 million minimum to $10 million, or the biggest blockbuster ever, which, like, you know, the Marvel movie, the DC and all that. So does your ability to work with low budgets, and not just the $1 million low budgets, but the low, low budgets, make you an asset to production companies and studios?
I mean, maybe, like, I think so. I think like it, that was certainly appealing with Layover and some of the movies I got after that. But I think that, you know, my biggest thing has always been how to take that kind of approach, that creative approach, right? That allows me to do tons of takes and allows me the really the freedom to shoot it how I want to shoot it and apply that to a 22-day shoot, you know? So it's certainly like, you know, if I look at a movie like Infamous, I never could have done that if it was my first feature, right? Like so much of the way we approached that and the way I wrote it was predicated on what I learned doing previous films, you know? And I think that, so to a degree, yes. But at the same time, I think that they still have their own expectations, you know, about things and about way money gets spent. And sometimes you bump up against that. So I think to a degree there is, I wouldn't say there's $1 million projects knocking down my door, nor that I even really want to do $1 million projects anymore. I think that that's actually gotten somewhat more challenging because look, like Layover is a sweet little story. I don't know if it's as valuable if we made it for 2 million, you know,
right.
I think that that's sort of like, and I think that that's true of a lot of scripts. I think frankly, like, you know, a lot of people come out thinking this is great, a great script that I wrote and it should have a $10 million production. And, you know, it's one of those things where you go, but does it, should it, right? Like, does this movie need to exist at 5 million? And I think that's often challenging, right? Like, I can't talk about the budget, but the movie I just directed, you know, is a movie that is, you know, it's about trauma and it's about fly fishing and it's about, you know, it's about Montana and, you know, it's not sort of this like commercial action thriller. You know, but it requires a certain amount of money to make it the right way, you know?
Right.
And so at some point at too low a budget, it you have to start changing the script. You have to radically rethink your approach. And at too high of a budget, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, what's tough is those movies that are supposedly in like the $6 to $10 million range. That's that's a really tough number, not only to get financed, but also to get sold, you know? And a lot of people, I'll hear people throw out like, I hope to make it for 10 million. I'm like, I don't think you really thought this through because that's going to be a very challenging number to get.
Yeah. Cause the 10 million's either at a certain point, you're leveling up all of the contracts you have to talk about. And so and, your $10 million budget gets you the same thing as a $4 million budget. You just need more money.
Right. Like, or, you know, I mean, there's the swing on IOTC is from 2.8 to 7.
Yes.
That's a big range.
Yes.
And if you're at 2.8 and you're still at that tier one, that's eating up a lot more of your budget than if you are at 7, you know? And so, so I think it's, you know, I think it's an asset to be able to go in confidently knowing like, here's how I execute this and here's how that, but I feel like I've left the stage of, oh, because you did something for 6, let's see what you can do with 5 million. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, or so I feel like I'm a little beyond that. I mean, my last
three precedes you.
Yeah, you know, and but also I'm getting the jobs or I'm pitching because either I wrote it and people seem to respond to it, or you know, I heard about it and I went and pitched on it, and I have, you know, like you know, part of the Montana thing was the fact that I fly fished. I understand that world, you know, and so that was an asset to the pitch that helped get me the job, and so. You know, I think it's that more so than like, well, I can do something for a buck, especially now because. Now, I felt that a lot after I did Layover, right?
Sure.
But then I did a number of things that were significantly higher budgeted that, you know, probably didn't do so well or weren't as great as they could have been. And so, you know, after doing all those and then now at the place I'm at, it's much less part of the conversation at this stage. But I know what it did was it allowed me to come into a lot of these things with confidence and know how to execute in a way that felt a little bigger than maybe the money we had, you know?
Do you feel like your experience in indie film all does give you like sort of a, because I've heard that television is more like independent film than like, you know, sort of high budgeted films where you get one that you sort of get the, you're sort of used to dealing with a faster pace and yeah. crews that are moved that super, because I know you've done a lot of directing for TV. So
I actually haven't. I haven't done really much TV.
Really?
I mean, I haven't. I did a series for Hulu that was like, not, I wouldn't really call that TV. That was like something else.
I mean, what do you call it then?
it was a glorified web series, really. You know, it was weird. It was just an odd, you know, 22 minutes episodes, but it wasn't a comedy. It was a drama. And I don't know. I've spoken my piece about that project, but you know, I think I actually am trying to get more into TV. Mm-hmm. But I haven't, I've just found myself sort of, you know, ending up getting jobs on and focusing much more on sort of, you know, this kind of quote unquote indie space, but with decent budgets.
Well, I mean, this seems, you know, there seems to be some sort of turn where people are sort of doing like quote unquote auteur television where they're hiring like one director for like an entire series. Like, I right. know Marvel has that sort of vibe, and like there are other people seem to be following suit where it's just like, and there was, you know, I think Atlanta does a lot of, you know, sort of the same directors.
Yeah.
But yeah, so
I mean, I would love to do that. I would love the idea, you know, of, and that's what always sort of bothered me about TV for a long time. And I you know, I had very little interest in doing episode 12, season 5 of some primetime show. You know, I can't say that I wouldn't take it if it came to me, right? That's a pretty good gig and it's a lot of money, but creatively it just had a lot of less interest because in that regard, the directors kind of just there. They're not really doing much in the way of like, you know, sort of really shaping a lot. And so to me, the bigger interest was, which I wasn't going to get, but the bigger interest is doing that, like, you know, the Soderbergh approach, or, you know, they did on Mare of Easttown, or just having that singular voice throughout many hours of TV is a fascinating idea to me. And I that to me is where TV gets really interesting.
This is a question for you both. As Paige, you've been a reader, worked in development. You guys have read, I'm sure, a lot of scripts. What are the kind of things that you see in low budget, quote unquote, low budget screenplays where sort of upcoming screenwriters don't seem to understand the realities or of production or independent film?
I'm going to give the depressing answer right now. I left development in part because it was kind of making me a cynic, and I'm not a cynic. But the thing that I would find reading low budget films, it's not about people's unawareness of budgetary constraints. It's unawareness of buyer interest and ability to raise the money. So you can have a really compelling, small, like a kitchen sink drama, but unless you're Andrea Arnold, and no one knows who Andrea, you know, if you're gonna be Andrea Arnold or not, it's going to be cramped and interior and sad and depressing, and you're not going to necessarily have a good enough part for the level of talent that you might need to get that $500,000. And if you get that $500,000, who's going to release a small kitchen sink drama on a large screen?
Right.
Not really anyone. It's going to get lost in Hulu. It's going to get lost in Netflix or any of the other billion streaming platforms now. So I think it's not about having to be super high concept or bold or brash, but it's about trying to find things that are going to make people excited and give them joy and make them think, and not make them feel like they're already closed off, or scare them. Horror is great. Like, make them feel more closed off in the life that they're already living. So I think just thinking about what types of things people want to see on the big screen. Even if you're making a small movie, you want to think about, are people going to want to spend $20 on a Friday night to go to the multiplex and see this?
Josh?
I mean, I don't have anything specific because I don't, you know, I actually find the opposite. I find it's difficult to find people writing for the indie space.
Really?
It's not really tied into a relationship with a director. You know, there's not a lot of scripts floating around there that are, I think, are worth even looking at that are sort of aimed at the indie space, right? Like, and aimed for like a $2 to $3 million budget film.
Really?
At least I've had trouble in the past really locking into anything that really makes sense at that level. But I would say that, like, the big thing for me, if you're looking at writer, you know, if you're talking about writing technique and all that stuff, is I think that what writers in a lot of stuff, a lot of at any budget level lack, is just the experience of knowing what it takes to bring something to screen, you know? And that's why I often say, like, if you're a young writer or whatever, like, the best thing you can do is to just get your stuff produced. I know that sounds easier than, you know, it is, but even just shorts, even just like, you know, when you write Man Falls Out of a Window, like, what goes into actually putting that on screen, that one line, you know, it's very challenging. And so I find that, like, you know, with writers that just haven't gone through the gauntlet of production, there's just less awareness on what something would take to accomplish, right? And so often any work I do, you know, with a writer, is a lot of it is just reframing it through the budget that we're going to have, you know, and the days that we're going to have, and, you know, what our schedule is going to look like and all that stuff, and trying to fit it in within the parameters of what we have, right? Which is a part of aspect of it that I really enjoy. I like that problem solving aspect of directing, but also just maintaining a sense of what they're trying to accomplish. Okay, you're doing this scene, you're trying to do this. Is there a less expensive version of it? Is there an alternative to this? Is there something different than this? You know, because this is just going to cost a lot of money. So if we're going to do that, it's got to be worth it.
Right.
You know, and really putting and really understanding that. I had a great lesson that sort of stuck with me. I had written a script and it was optioned by this guy, Todd Kobernicki, who is from Guy Walks Into a Bar. He produced Elf. He wrote Sully. And he had optioned it, and we got to work with him. It was like kind of our first real experience working with a great director. And we had a scene that was like, you know, half page of these guys at lunch. And it was supposed to be part of like an on sequence where they were just this guy and this kid were kids were getting to know each other, and it was supposed to be just a representative of a good time. Right.
Right.
And he pointed out and he said, so this is a half day. Mm-hmm. This is a company move. It's a half day. And right now the scene's not justifying that. So can it happen somewhere else? Can we lose it? Right. And so really going, oh, okay. So this is like, you know, putting in these types of scenes, it better be worth it, because the act of what's required to get them.
Right.
You know, is going to be challenging. And I, you know, we ran into that on our latest film. We had, you know, a script was probably 120 pages, which felt right. And you know, we had to do, there was a lot of stuff that got left on the cutting room floor, you know, that we spent a lot of time trying to get that we thought we needed. And you go all those days and all that time and all that money, like, you know, on these scenes that just, they don't work once you put it all together. And so, you know, but I think that that's an aspect of it, you know, that's important, is just getting a sense of what things cost to put together. And then the other side of it too, that's weird and striking to me, is that I find that it's strange that so many execs actually care who the writer is. You know, like when you're trying to package a movie or an indie movie, they're like, oh, this is a no-name writer or first-time writer. I'm like, so? Like, who cares? the script is great. What's the difference?
Here's the difference is. Everyone's looking for a reason to say no because they don't want to be blamed when it doesn't do anything. I mean, that's...
It's a bullshit no. That's
exactly. 100%.
Right. Yeah. But you go, I get that, you know, one a lot.
And so, you know, to me, I think the issue is and that's why you get these guys, right? Who like they'll go write a $100 million movie and it won't sell, because they're just like, well, wait, we're not going to spend, you know. So it's this weird thing where they say, well, write the big movie, write the movie that's marketable, write the movie that's this. But right now that's all massive tentpole stuff. And if people are writing that and they're no name writers, like they're just not going to, nobody's going to buy that script. You know, right. Maybe you hear about the one that gets through, right. But it's a much, you know, it's just, there's a weird thing around that I don't totally understand. Because frankly, I think it's a good script is a good script, and you're not asking the writer to do anything else other than approve the sale, you know, like you can buy it and fire them and get somebody else to come in and fix it if you think it needs to be fixed. You don't have to use the person that wrote it.
Right.
So whereas with like a director, I understand, oh, this guy's only directed one movie, or he's only done, you know, this short, like how can we trust him with a really big film? But with writers, I don't really understand that perspective. But I think that's another thing, which is like, well, you don't, you know, if you write something too small, who's really buying that? What's the market for something that's really small if you're not making it yourself? And if you write something too big, they're just not, they're just, I don't know. I don't think, I've heard too many stories of people writing big scripts that never sold because they're just too big. And the response is like, well, they're just not known writers. You know, that's a weird thing, but okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's like, I've sort of experienced that myself when going through and, you know, Josh, we sort of talked about this a little bit online where, you know, like I have some things like that sort of came up with like, you know, my producer, Rod, and he ended up putting up that really great thing up on Twitter that I talked about in the previous podcast. But like, for me, it just, like you said, it seems weird to me where it's like you said, if you're talking about a director, be like, well, he's never directed a movie of this size, you know, that sort of thing. But for me, it's like, if you like the script, what else do you need from the writer? Like if the script is good, what's the problem? Like the writer's there to write. And if the script is written well, then the writer has done his job. Why didn't
And I think it's, you know, look, I think at the end of the day too, like studios are very focused on very high budget things. Mm-hmm. The streamers want packages, right? And so there's still a space in indie film. I mean, you know, Rob, having read your stuff, I can tell you it's not at all surprising me that no studio has interest in that. And not even really because of the subject matter. It's just because of the level of movie that it would be. And that it's just like, you know, it doesn't fit into a box, you know, that they can sell. And so that's not surprising. And no offense to Rod, but he's probably not a big enough director to just push it through. Right. Like clearly he's done some great stuff, but as a narrative feature director, he just might not have the cachet to say, you know, and like Paige said, it might just be like, well, we don't know the writer, is their way of gently saying we're a pass, but don't get pissed off and not come to us with the next one. Cause you never know. That's the easiest thing. They want to come up with whatever excuse they can. Right. The best one is, well, we've got something similar, which 99% of the time is not true, but it's an easy way to say, we can't take it or we're not interested without it. You know, look, today, you know, this is today's trash is tomorrow's gold. You know, like you don't ever really know. And it's all based on relationships. So they don't want to piss people off because while they don't want to put the money up, somebody else could, you know, and they want to have the option on the next one, you know? And so I think it's like, if you're in the indie space, it's about finding a director that can champion you and can also like, you know, deliver on financing based on the script, you know? And so like in the case of our previous movie, the writer, Stephen Camilio, he was a first time writer. You know, this is the first script the second script he's had produced, but the other one was like a friend deal, like, you know, much, much smaller. This is his first significant thing. And I can tell you like his involvement had no impact on us finding the financing from an indie perspective, right? It might've been if we had gone to a studio, but we were never gonna get this made at a studio. So I think the challenge is that there's this big space between 6 million and 20 million, maybe 30 million now at this point, that is a dead zone. Nobody's touching it. Yep. Unless you're in series, right? Like I know, you know, Squid Game, I think was like 20 million or something like that for the series. So unless you're in that world, yes, but that's a different thing. And so in the feature world, and then so I think it's like, you know, if you're going through the studio thing, I think it's, I mean, I'd be just a writer right now, like to be honest. I think that trying to make it as a screenwriter in this climate is probably the hardest thing that you can do. And I think that it's just very, very challenging. And so, you know, I think that it's just about finding, especially in the indie space, if you want to write original stuff and you want to write really aggressive stuff, it's about being in the indie space and just finding that right director, that right producer that's willing to do it, you know, and willing to make it. And, you know, but I think the days of like the spec sales and, you know, selling the original script are just very, very long. They might come back around, but they're not happening right now. You know, you have exceptions for sure, but, you know, it's just a different climate, you know, which is really challenging, you know? And so I think, you know, so it's, you know, that's my perspective. I don't know if it's true, but that I think is quite the challenge, is like if you're at an under $6 million range, that's a particular type of movie and you got to have the right people that are willing to back it, you know, and that's a non-studio approach. you know, and I think, or it's just having a piece of really juicy attachment, whether it's an actor, whether it's a, you know, a director, whether it be, or it's a producer, you know, there's guys that can still get that made and can still support or back that level of financing. But if you're in that anywhere above six and under 20, it's like, forget it. Just put that in the drawer until you're bigger or you meet somebody that'll push it through, you know? But I just think too, it's like, it also comes back to like, you know, everybody wants to be a screenwriter. And it's not to say that certain story, you know, that people's stories shouldn't be told, but I don't know if every script deserves to be a movie. And I think everybody thinks that it does, you know, and you just read things, you know, often you just go, why is this a film? I'd read stuff all the time. Like I used to work in development. I worked in digital, but it'd be like, you know, it'd always be like, should this really be a movie? Like, I don't know why this is a movie, you know, and not that we should have gatekeepers and that everything needs to be a certain thing, but you just, there are things inherent to like a film that sort of work, even for films that are non IP based, you know, and things like that. They're just, you just tell, you know, and you just see what it's adding up to and with a point that it's trying to make. And you just kind of realize like, yeah, this should be a movie or it shouldn't be a movie. And 99% of them shouldn't be a movie.
Well, there are movies I feel like that sort of like defy, like, because my thing is, I think one of my favorite movies of all time that I don't know that would get made like today would be like RoboCop. Like, you know, say what you want about the thing. Like the concept is very high concept, but it's such an oddly toned movie. Like it's an action film, but not really. But it's like a
but human that's all drama. Verhoeven.
Right.
Yeah. All Verhoeven. You know, that movie is a different movie without Verhoeven.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I mean, I could tell you there's like, to me, Crush Pizza does not get made unless it's a Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Yeah.
100%. That's a novel or a short story.
Yeah.
Maybe, right? I mean, yeah. I guess. Like, but to me, and I loved it. Like, I really loved it. But I love P.T. Anderson. But no way anybody makes that movie or says yes to that movie unless it's just him. And it's him 20 plus years into his career.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that's often the challenge that I have is like, you know, people are like, oh, you know, there's so many doors that get slammed in your face or there's so many no's and you see certain movies get yeses and you're like, well, that's only a yes because of who's involved, right? Yeah. It has very little to do with the story or whether even that should be a movie, right? And like, you know, and to a degree that's tough, but in some ways they've earned it and they've earned the right to make the projects that they couldn't get made much earlier, you know?
Right.
But also those types of people have to start somewhere, and I'm speaking a little bit from my own personal experience here, where there are some, like the auteur theory is that there are certain stories that only one person can tell. That's a branch of it anyway. And when you read a script, you can't necessarily tell whether that's going to turn into a good movie or not, because the script, I don't like the, you know, a script is a blueprint of a movie thing, but it's a document that guides the creation of a film that is, of a thing that's live and off of the paper. Mm-hmm. And my I was making Interrobang, which is my short form comedy anthology series, and the first day of production stopped in the middle for a quick break, and my DP turned to me and said, I did not get this when I read it, but now that I'm hearing it and I'm seeing it, I understand it and it's awesome. And he didn't have to say that to me. He could have just shut up and done his job, but like the fact that to him, if he was one of the gatekeepers, he would have said, this isn't a movie, and thrown it away, which is what some of the other people who I've shown it to did do. And then it premiered at Seattle International Film Festival, played at Dances with Films, nominated for Best Comedic Series at Minnesota Web Fest, all this. And it's, I mean, I think it's good, but if you're just basing it off the script, you can't necessarily tell whether it's going to be a movie unless you share the same vision as the person who knows what it's supposed to be.
Right.
And so it's all subjective. There's not objectively, I mean, there's some things that are objectively not a movie, like the a script I once got, which was literally a man sitting in a chair for 90 minutes spouting nonsense. But then again, you film that, you got like it was him talking about how he was going to take a shower and then a bucket of oil poured on his head. And Andy Warhol films that though, and it's in MoMA. So who knows?
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that the challenge is that scripts are not inherently anything other than a plan, really. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't really function very well other than that. I think because And I think it's rare that a script really does, where you really read it, right? And like, it jumps off the page in that way, you know, but that it requires so much more for it to sort of fulfill its purpose.
100%.
You know, and that's inherently challenging with them, because it's like, you know, you want to inject style, but then sometimes people say don't inject style because it needs to be, you know, it's like, it's a weird, scripts are weird things.
See, I disagree with that completely, because for me, like, I want the script to jump off the page. For me, like, I want it to feel like a movie while you're reading it. And so for like that craft, I think I'm constantly in search of that craft of getting it to where someone wants to not just turn pages, but wants to can see it. Like, I want you to be able to see it. And that's about word choice. And that's about, you know, even the way you do slug lines and the way that the thing flows on the page and the amount of white space and the, like, all of these things that they talk about that are sort of screenwriting quote unquote rules. Like, I feel like some right. of them are actually worth something. Like, you know, there is such a thing as too much on the page, but you can, you know, there, I always think about the first line of The Gunslinger, Stephen King's The Gunslinger. The man in black, you know, walked through the desert and the gunslinger followed behind. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're immediately transported to a place.
Right.
Like a sentence, a single sentence. And that's screenwriting in a nutshell. Like, if you can do that, like, you know, and give people a sense of size and scope, you know, but you've got to be able to do that. It's got to jump off the page. Like, that is something that's going to keep you wanting to read more. You know, not everybody has that ability. Some people, I think.
Right. Have, I mean, I agree with you, right? Mm-hmm. I agree with that. A lot of people just don't have it, you know?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just like, and yeah. it's, and they don't necessarily need it, because there's plenty of scripts that don't have that, that have been translated into great movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the eternal question is like, what is it about that? Right? Is yes. it the whole? Is it the character? Like, how do you take this like very simplistic description of action, you know, this usually fairly simple dialogue, and how does that add up to something great? Right? Like, it's always, it's ethereal in some ways, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that there's clear examples of like entertaining scripts to read, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the classic like Shane Black, you know, he's like, oh yeah. $3 million, just like the $3 million I'm going to spend on my house when I sell the script, you know, and things like that. Like, but at the same time, none of that has anything to do with the film.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, that's also the challenge. I think that there's the other side of it is that there's usually, to me, I've been really looking at it saying, well, we have two drafts. There's a reader draft, which you need to send to people to get them to read it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a production draft. And those yes. are inherently two very, very different things.
Yeah.
You know? And so often, you know, it's about then once you go into production, it's about translating that draft into something that's like much more quote unquote, like a blueprint, mm-hmm. you know, or as sort of a, you know, and that's when I think lottery rules sort of stop being relevant, right? Like there's too much on the page or there's too much this or not enough this. Like, I think that I tend to start injecting into the production draft, even notes on like, hey, we need to do, you know, I look at it much more as a tool rather than a piece of literature, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that'll translate to me where I'll be very specific about things. Like it's this type of weapon and it needs to be this, or like, you know, to me, because I'm like, that's the document that all of my production staff are referencing. And if I can put stuff in there that's going to help them, I'll do that. I don't need it to read like a piece of literary literature anymore, because like we've sold it, and, you know, having lines that are relevant to what we need in the film doesn't help me, right? I need this to be a document that everybody is a central point of reference, and I don't need to be literature anymore. So right. That's another aspect of it, you know, and translating that and taking stuff out that you don't need because it's irrelevant at this point.
Yeah, I think that's, you're definitely right where I feel like, but if you're a screenwriter, you're definitely writing for that reader draft. Like that thing that's supposed to be like, mm-hmm. you know, the thing until it gets sold. Like you said, until it gets sold, that's what it is. It is essentially, you should treat it like, you know, a specific, very specific kind of literature. It should be something that, you know, you could read on a, like a long lunch break, or, you know, like sort of something like a, you know, something that somebody can enjoy, you know, even on the toilet, like that sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like, right. You want it to be like the equivalent of like a really great magazine article. If there's a, right. You know, where, you know, people don't really read magazines anymore, but like, but okay. But, sort of final question, and this is for both of you again, do you enjoy writing? Like, I famously have said, like I'm a weirdo in that. So there are some people who say, I don't enjoy writing, but I enjoy having written. But I'm one of those people who actually enjoys the craft of writing, mostly because a lot of my first drafts are by hand. And I'm sort of a weirdo for pens and notebooks. But do you guys enjoy writing, or what's your relationship to that?
I love it. I'm also one of those weirdos. To me, it's like story time, except I get to tell the story that I want to, I get to both tell and listen to the story that I want to hear. And then sometimes if I get into a flow, I get to surprise myself with a line of dialogue or a turn of phrase, or something happens to the characters and I'm completely shocked, even though I'm the one that's doing it all. There's a bit of a magic in storytelling. And also in the fact that if I realize, you know what, I don't like this story all of a sudden, I don't like that this happened, I can erase it and then make it real, like make that change real and not just create a headcanon.
Right.
And being able to tell the stories that I want to hear, that feel true to me, that are things that I don't get to see in the world, and the act of writing them down, and it's creation, and it's really cool. And I love it.
Josh?
I enjoy the idea of writing. Like, I like the idea of writing, but I like it when I'm in it.
Right.
But generally, I don't like writing. Not that I don't like it. It's often a struggle for me. And I very much think of myself as a director who writes, mm-hmm. as opposed to a writer who directs. So like I'm, you know, like Rob, you told me, like, you'd take a vacation, you'd sit down and write a script. Like, I can't do that. Like, yeah. I like take a long time. Like, I don't write everything that I direct. I don't write anything that's just to sell. Not that I wouldn't, but I just don't, you know, but when I have an idea and I really like the idea and I can sort of settle into a groove, then I really look forward to it every day. You know, and I really enjoy the process of sitting down and working my way through it. You know, that becomes very enjoyable. But I don't find myself liking to do it all the time. you know, but often I also, like, frankly, I'm a guy that likes breaks. I basically just spent the last, you know, year and a half, and I have a couple more months to go on the latest film. You know, and it's hard for me to sort of like do multiple things at the same time, like, especially with my schedule. Like, Rob, I have nothing against you, you know, nothing on you, but, you know, I've got two kids. I've got, you know, other stuff. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you're like, oh, please. But I've reached a point where, like, I spent so much of my time when I was in my 20s, like at cafes and writing and using up that time, that now I'm like, I've settled into a certain level of comfortability with like my career. And so I'd like to sort of take time off and like to let stuff gestate and let stuff sort of rise to the surface and, you know, sort of like work their way through my process before I really sit down to do anything. But I'm very envious of the people that can just sit down and start typing stuff out. Like I'm very much not that. One of the things I do really love is I really love rewriting. Like, okay. I really love revisions and rewriting. Like I rewrite everything that I work on, even if I didn't write it initially, and even if I'm just partnered with the writer. But I love getting into something that already exists and working off that. It's probably why I'm more of a director than a writer.
Yeah.
I do find the blank page is very difficult for me to get going. Like, once I get going, I'm fine.
Well, that's great. I'll write something and then you can rewrite it, because I hate rewriting.
Oh, there you go. I mean, for years, that's what we did. Like, I had a writing partner, and the way that we did our first couple scripts is, like, he was more of the writer. So, like, he would start and he would start writing. And then, like, I would come in the next day and I would write right behind him. I would rewrite what he had just written, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, in effectively the same time frame, we would come out with a second draft of a script.
Right.
You know, and that I really love that aspect. And I love it when we're in production and we're having to figure things out and we're retyping and coming up with stuff and rewriting. Yeah. Like that, that I all love. But the blank page is tough. It's not sort of scary anymore. It used to be scary, but it just takes a bit, you know. And this is another little weird thing that I do, since this is about screenwriting, is like when I was writing Infamous, and I feel like every script, the process changes for me. Like it's always a different process, right? But like one of the things I really did that I liked on Infamous when I was writing it, because I ended up writing the first draft in about 10 days, was I'd spent a lot of time sort of just outlining and coming up with what the story was going to be. But I would sit down at the beginning of each day, and in my notebook, I would sort of in prose write out what I was supposed to be doing that day. So it was sort of like I've read these like Steinbeck journals and like all this kind of, like those are great insights into the writing process with, you know, he's written journals about writing Grapes of Wrath and writing East of Eden and all that stuff. And, but what I would do is I would literally sit down and say, okay, so in the beginning, this is going to happen. And this is, you know, what's going to come next. And, you know, I'm not really sure about, oh, well, what if this, like you, if you read it, it would just seem like a stream of consciousness. Like, and I would write till I got to basically the next beat. Like I would, if I beat it out 12 beats, 10 beats, whatever, 10, the major beats, I would write until I arrived at that beat. And then I would basically then set the journal notebook aside and I would start typing and I would type the script.
Nice.
And it was this weird way of like figuring my way through it without the pressure of coming up with the dialogue or writing something that was actually going to be in the script. It was like this weird trick to basically get into the writing without committing myself to writing yet, you know, and I could sort of like work my way through it. And what was happening from the perspective of, okay, I'm going to write today. This is what I'm writing. The character is going to do this. And then that's going to lead to the character doing this. And, oh, what if she ended up doing this, right? And asking a lot of questions and like things like that through the 10 pages that I was writing. And then I would sit down, I would type, and it would all come out. And it's a very weird little thing, but you know, I always find those tricks to be fascinating.
Yeah, I love writing hacks like that, which sort of takes us into our next sort of thing. What are we writing, consuming, watching? And I'm doing sort of this very similar thing, or where I don't outline because I can't stand it. I feel like I'm writing something twice, like I don't want to write myself like a map to follow. I hate that. So what I do is I do like character Bibles where I write like where everyone is coming from. Like I'll do like an entire page of like for each character, like their sort of personal history. And then I'll do like dispositions, like where everyone is coming from. And then sometimes I'll even go back and do like, you know, that scene by scene where I'm like, what does everybody want in this scene? And sort of just knowing that just allows me to like go back to the page and sort of figure out like what the sort of scene is about. Because I've sort of, most of what I'm doing is like reverse engineering. If I, especially if I'm writing what I'm writing right now, I'm writing something that I'm going to shoot myself. And I had this thing with my producer this week where we just sort of went back and it was just like, we came up with a device that would sort of do what you were talking about earlier, which is eliminate those little scenes that are like, this is a half a day or a half of, you know, this in this area that's going to scream indie film budget and that we don't want to do, I don't want to do it anyway. That's just right. Annoying. So just figure out how to do that creatively someplace else. So to sort of justify the location. So, you know, for me, it was, you know, I'm very much about finding out where the characters are coming from. And that sort of, for me, if I know what the characters are doing, where they're coming from, it's much easier to put them in a situation and then just go rather than trying to.
Well, it leaves a certain level of spontaneity.
Yeah.
Without it being just literally coming up with it right then and there.
Right.
You know, that's why I like the beats. I don't outline either. I find that outlining or writing treatments is a different skill. Right. Like I don't like writing movies in prose form. Like it doesn't work for me. Like I like the script format. I'll stay in the script format. I don't want to suddenly try to write a novel version, right? Of like, like it's just a flip in how you're writing it. And I don't like it. So yeah. I tend to not do treatments.
It's worst like a persuasive case if I, essay for a script.
Yeah. Yeah. Like worst case if I have to, I'll do like a scriptment where I'm writing slug right. lines and descriptions of scenes and just no dialogue. I don't love that, but like worst case I'll do it, because at least I'm like halfway to having a script at that point. Mm-hmm. But I do find that like I really like sort of beat sheets, you know, and beating it out, because I sort of have a roadmap of destinations without knowing exactly what road I'm taking.
Right.
You know, I'm like sort of like, okay, I know I need to get here, and I want to leave how I get there open a little bit, at least in the first draft, see what comes. So that I find the looser I am with it, even though there's still a sense of where it's going, is much more helpful to me than sort of ironing it all out before I actually start writing the script.
And I, you know,
I do like discovery, right? Like to me, I think that the most exciting thing to me at any level of filmmaking is the aspect of discovery. It's mm-hmm. when you take one and one and suddenly you get three.
Yeah.
Right. It's mm-hmm. like, and it's that, you know, Paige, you talked about that sort of the magic of the way in which that kind of works and film works, like, you know, that aspect of discovering something that you could not have planned, you know, whether it's, you know, a line of dialogue or whether it's sort of a performance that you never could have told an actor to do, mm-hmm. or it's the way in which these two shots that you did marry together in a way that you hadn't exactly planned mm-hmm. on production, but now they're in the edit. The sort of ephemeral, you know, hard to pin down nature of filmmaking.
Alchemy. Yeah.
Yeah. Is often to me always the most exciting part. So leaving room for that in the process. And not that you can't have that, you know, Paige, to your point, if you're actually outlining or you're being very specific, but I lean in that direction. And that's why that sort of speaks to me more so than like knowing exactly where I'm going and having everything planned out. But I think that's all the crazy thing about writing, right? Like it's, everybody writes so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I love rewriting, and I love the process of discovery within a first draft, but getting through the first draft always feels so intimidating to me that I like, right. And also I write long. So I've had cases where I've not outlined so much and written 192 page first draft, which is a whole issue. And I use my outline as a way to basically get out the first draft jitters before I actually draft it. Yeah. So I will write out, and it's not a script or any forward-facing document beyond the fact that my writing group needs to be able to understand what's happening in my brain. And I'll right. beat out every scene. And then when I'm ready to write, I will print it out, put it, the paper version, next to my computer, and just 10 pages a day. And within 2 weeks, I'll have a first draft of a script. And then I can get into the rewrite, which I'm with you, Josh. I love it. It's there's something about that that's freeing, because you have a thing already set. So then yeah. you can start playing with it. There's no, oh no, what if I put that here, will the whole tower fall apart? The tower's already there. You can
right.
decorate it how you want.
Well, and it's exciting, because what I like about it is like it just gives you a basis from which to work off of. And I find that my creativity flourishes much more in that regard than if it yeah. was like starting from zero. I was going to say the funny thing though is like for me as a director, and I've come up on this a couple times now, as I start to look at other projects and I join a project that's got a script, I actually am starting to ask writers if they have outlines or treatment versions of the film, of the script. And the reason why is this: I find it very challenging to work through issues when you have a script in front of you. Mm-hmm. Like I need to see, like if we're talking about structural issues, I need to back up to that 30,000 foot view,
right?
You know, to see a beat sheet, to see a treatment, you see like, okay, this is what's in the script. Oh, that's where it's, that's, this stuff needs to move around, right? It's hard for me to see a big picture when you're looking at a sort of linear document in that way. Yeah. And so it's like, I don't do them, but now I'm like constantly asking writers, do you have a shortened version of this so that we can look at where the issues might be as we look at revising or look at something like that. And so that's a bit of a quirk, I guess, so that yeah. That I have, but I find that to be helpful, because I often think, like, you know, scripts always need work, you always need to cut stuff, yeah. you always need to look at things, and it's right. hard to sort of get the view of it that you need just reading it. It's like, I want to see note cards on the ground, I want to see it up on a whiteboard, I want to see what our structure looks like, I want to see what's happening here. And then you can go, okay, well, then that's where we need to focus and that's where we need to revise, mm-hmm. you know, and it's much easier to see that, you know, in that form than it is in a script format.
Yeah. When I was working in development, I actually created Excel spreadsheets of scripts that would have like columns for documenting where the emotional high points were. And you could kind of, I called it akin to a score of a symphony, because each line would be one page, and I wouldn't break it down page by page, but scene by scene. And then I'd, you know, merge the cells that all the pages of that scene were in. And it, just this spreadsheet where you look at it and you say, oh, well, look at that. And did this with horror, with comedy, especially. Oh, look at that. There are no jump scares, or there's no tension from pages 35 to 42. No wonder it feels slow there. And all of a sudden,
as much as
you don't want to break down a script into its parts, at a certain point, finding where and why those places don't feel quite right can be super helpful. So I completely understand what you mean about needing that thousand.
Like, you know, it's that kind of thing where you're reading something, you're like, something's not working, and I just can't put my finger on what. Right. I just don't know what it is about. And I can't, in the stage we're in, suss it out by looking at the script. It's just not going to give me the answer.
Yeah.
See, I'm sort of a weirdo in that, like, I don't know. If you, like, I'm viewing the movie, like, if I feel like, just because I think I'm like a weird freak about like sort of documents or books and stuff like that, like I'm sort of seeing it that way, or the way that, I don't know, the way that my brain works, like I'm sort of able to, like, I'll be the person who's reading and be like, I don't understand where this is going, and I can see, like, you can sort of tell the difference between somebody who's like laying a trail of breadcrumbs and someone who doesn't know where they're going. And like, you know, some people just sort of figure it out, and then they get to the end of a story, like they've done the, like, a outline or something, and they got through their outline and they got through their script. But then you're looking at this and you're like, you did this on page 2, but you could have paid it off on page 22, mm-hmm. or like you did this on page 5, then we don't hear about it again until page 35. So you could have paid this off way before that. You didn't, because I'm very much in that sort of Shane Black, like, set it up, pay it off, set it up, pay it off, set it up, pay it off. And for me, like, if the movie doesn't have those things, like, it feels like you're in the hands of a novice. Like, I live and die on setups and payoffs. Like, the beginning, like, that there are certain things from, like, Save the Cat that I sort of love, like opening image, final image, like that sort of thing. And the other thing that I really love is setups and payoffs. Like, those things just make a script. The best movies have those sort of things, you know, of like Marty McFly not being able to start the car, like at the end of the thing, like those, that kind of stuff just drives me crazy. And you see, like, you read screenplays without them, and that for me is like you're just missing the math. Like, I, like, what was this? For me, like, it's not a movie. Like, you're, and I think that's one of the things that Rod and I sort of get, where, like, we'll both say to, like, you know, each other, be like, you know, this is a movie. Like, you can see what it is. It may have problems, but it's a movie. There are certain scripts, a lot of scripts, I feel like, you get them and you're like, this is not a movie. Somebody will send it to you and you're just like, okay, well, you clearly haven't done enough research, and your characters aren't well developed. The things that I'm reading don't have any setups or payoffs. And it's like, do you understand that this is a movie? Like, this is like, there are things that the movies have, you know, that, like, think of your favorite movies. Does your movie have any of those elements? Like, where are they? And for me, I'm just like a weird, I think most of it is just about setups and payoffs. And I feel like if people don't have those things, you can just sort of pull back and be like, all right, I understand what's going on here. Like, this isn't good. And, like, this is why. And the other thing I can't stand is bad dialogue. That really just drives me crazy, more than anything. But that's a whole different topic for another day.
That's a different podcast.
Yeah, that's a whole different podcast. In terms of what, like, I did this thing again this week where it took me a whole week to watch a movie, just because I've been working so much. I'm trying to do a Desiree Akiva deep dive, starting with her movie, Appropriate Behavior. But I did watch, I am enjoying Hawkeye. And on sort of a nerdy note, I discovered a cappella covers of video game soundtracks. There's a guy doing like a cappella versions of like tracks from Sonic the Hedgehog and Tetris. and man, I don't, why, I don't, like, I'm just that nerd who was just like listening to this like all week. Like Ice Cap Zone, which is stage 5 from Sonic 3, because I'm a nerd, and Power Plant Zone from Sonic 2, this is the second stage. Man, that was great. Just like finding those tracks like that. And then also finding the original 16-bit tracks. Yeah, I'm so glad that we live in a time where like nerdery has now been monetized and that you could like find those kind of things. Like I'm the type of weirdo who still looks up, like, especially in terms of 16-bit soundtracks, like there are rock covers of Comic Zone soundtrack. I don't know if anybody had a Sega Genesis, but I did, and Comic Zone was one of my favorite games. And the soundtrack to it is amazing. And so there are a lot of weirdos like me who have done rock covers of the soundtrack, and man, that stuff is fun to listen to. That was my week. How about you, Paige?
So as far as what I'm watching, aside from Succession, which is amazing this season, I have gotten really into School of Chocolate on Netflix, which now that Great British Bake Off, the season's over, there's the holiday season, but that is different. This sort of takes its place. It's a gentle cooking reality show. I love food. I love cooking. I love baking. And this is about, I believe it's either eight pastry chefs who are basically, they're doing a competition for pastry creation and chocolate showpieces, but there's no eliminations. And if you do a bad job, the head chef, host, teacher will take you aside and say, hey, this is what you need to improve on, and I'll give you a private lesson. And there's team competitions, making chocolate showpieces. People make these incredible pastries that, you know, something looks like a sandwich, but it's actually coconut cake. And really just lovely, good food, good people, nice vibes. Great for relaxing into the end of the year. And then talking about all this outlining, I'm actually finishing up an outline for Kaleidoscope, which is going to be my debut feature as a director. And I am going to start drafting that on the 16th, and we'll finish a draft before the end of the year, and going to be filming about that while I'm doing it, which is crazy. I hate being on camera, but I like doing YouTube. That's my week, is finishing up Kaleidoscope and watching a Kaleidoscope outline and watching School of Chocolate.
Josh, take us home.
Well, I spent the last week in LA doing color on the latest movie. So we were at Harbor Picture Company doing all the work on that. And then, watching Succession, Yellowstone, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, that kind of stuff. Honestly, like, I don't watch much TV or much movies. I don't really have the time. And so, you know, it's nice to be able to kind of wind down the end of the year, catching up on some stuff. And, but yeah, that's about it. Not much.
Yeah. All right. This week's resource is the Indie Film Hustle interviews. There are, I think, two or three of them, with Josh Caldwell.
There's three. Yeah,
there's three. Alex Ferrari is a friend of the show. And he's also one of the patron saints of indie film. And I've listened to all of his interviews with Josh, and they are chock full of indie goodness. And those will be linked in his show notes. And this is our show for this week. Screenwriting from the Trenches can be found on Anchor, Apple, Google, and Spotify podcasts, as well as KevinLMartin.com. And since we are a new podcast, we appreciate it if you dropped us a like or rated us 5 stars on whatever platform you patronize, because algorithms. For questions that we can and answer on the show, my email is rob@bespectaclemofo.com. You can also find us on Twitter at bespectaclemofo. Paige, you are?
At PFeld.
And Josh?
At Joshua_Caldwell.
Kay is at Kay Tux, and these things, as well as my YouTube channel, where the digital series, How to Make a Movie for $1,000, season two of which is about to start up, will all be linked in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening. We hope that you continue to do so. Now stop procrastinating. Those pages aren't going to write themselves, folks. Josh, thank you so much for agreeing to be our guinea pig. Paige, stepping in with the assist, with the co-host. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time, folks.